Today is August the 23rd, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and in the studio with me is my colleague, Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York, on the radio, and the program is live-streamed on the Internet at WBAI.org at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM, WBAI.org, and our own website, PCRadioshow.org. When WBAI is in a membership drive, a replacement program may be scheduled, but the regular program will always continue to be available each week on PRN.FM. And, Joe, it's a pretty nice weather in New York today. It's a pretty decent weather, and we had quite a bit of, a big news item with Kaspersky.
It's a very strange news item because you and I both have respected and recommended Kaspersky for many years. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, Kaspersky is an antivirus, anti-malware development company. They're headquartered in the former Soviet Union, what is now called the Russian Federation. And according to the FBI, the United States FBI, Kaspersky has very close relations with the Kremlin. And because of that, the FBI is recommending that any of the United States companies that might have sensitive information or sensitive problems, such as the power grid or the water supply, not use anything from Kaspersky. Now, Kaspersky says this is foolish, and if anybody doesn't trust their software, they would be happy to provide to the FBI a copy of their source.
And they also use open source software so that you could easily just get it without even asking.
Well, but the open source is integrated into their right. own software, so that doesn't really pertain. But I was curious, and so I did a search on the news whether the FBI had actually accepted the Kaspersky offer, and I could find no record of the FBI accepting and examining the Kaspersky software. I then did a little bit more research and found that the FBI was not just recommending that the power grid or the water supply be companies controlling that be afraid of and avoid the Kaspersky software. The FBI has been recommending that all corporations in the United States avoid using Kaspersky.
Well, that's guilt by association. I mean, like...
No, that's guilt not by association. Hank, that's like saying if you want to avoid war with the Germans, you just don't enter war with the Germans, and that's guilt by association. No, that's accusing Kaspersky of being a corrupt organization.
Well, I'll how about looking at it from the other person's point of view, okay?
I never can do that.
Yes, you can, because the other person's point of view is, let's say, India or China, which...
I strongly feel that the exact same thing should be said about all Chinese software.
Well, No. What if the Chinese government says, we strongly advise you don't use Microsoft Windows because
They already have said that.
They didn't ban it, okay? It's a difference.
They will ban it next. And also the FBI has not banned it either.
Well...
No, there's no well. It's a completely analogous situation. I happen to feel very strongly that we should not have any sensitive situations such as the power grid open to the Chinese government or the Russian government. The question becomes, in a totalitarian society like China, is there any such thing as a private company? I say there isn't. In Russia, I also say there isn't. There are people constantly arguing with me on this point, and I recognize it. I don't sympathize with it. I just feel strongly that if you have sensitive information, you only allow your closest friends to share it.
Okay, Joe, let me ask you this question then. We have listeners out there that have been using with great satisfaction the Kaspersky antivirus utility. Should they continue using it?
Excuse me. I'm one of those people.
So are you going to continue using
it? No.
What are you going to replace it with?
There are any number of programs I can use that are comparable. Some of them are actually public, not public domain, but...
No, it's include like Defender is part of the operating
right.
system.
And there are others.
And actually, it's pretty good because they've broken up into two parts now.
The Finnish company, ESET...
ESET, right.
...is one that I am very much in favor of because they have the even more protections than this country offers. That's a company I would trust and recommend right now.
So even though you don't run a power grid, you don't do any government work, you don't have anything sensitive, Joe, you're just saying that based on a broad overview, you'll just switch software.
I'm just saying that I don't think that I should ignore the warning that's been given to me by the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Okay, enough said. Another thing that came out that actually it was a piece of news item that is effective September 11th, and that's unusual because that's 9/11, and that is 20 years ago I was railing at the patent office because to me it was the dumbest patent approval, and that was... one-click transaction that Amazon got as a patent, and I said, "What you mean? You mean it's not a piece of software? It's a procedure that you use one click to, complete a transaction." I mean, like that's like to me so obvious, but they got it.
Wait a minute, to you it's very obvious. Then how come nobody had used it before?
Sure, they did.
No, they didn't.
No, that's not true, Joe. They did, okay? The question is, no one applied for a patent. Apple did, okay? There's a difference.
Apple,
and therefore...
Amazon, not Apple.
I'm sorry, not Apple. Amazon, okay?
I'm not sure.
The reason why I said Apple is because Apple is actually paying Amazon to use it for their Apple store.
I'm going to do something which, in a way, it's blindsiding you, and I've never done before on the air. I don't recall any company actually having a one-click sales procedure. You say that there has been much before that.
Well, you got to remember, my interpretation is you're talking about one-click per se with a computer. I'm saying, to me, it's a one-act procedure to do a transaction. There's a difference now.
I don't see the difference, and I'll go further. If you say...
Because, by the way, the patent that the patent office has been allowing these patents because there is a computer factor to it. And so they've been allowing
I'm not sure that factor entered into this particular decision. It wasn't properly challenged. But aside from all of that, you're telling me that the equivalent of a one-click procedure was in existence before the Amazon patent, and I'm now going to challenge you and tell me specifically where it was in use.
Where it was in use?
Yes.
Very simple. A lot of the downloading of...
No, not a lot of. Give me a specific.
Well, if you're asking me for a specific, I can't give to you right now, but I could tell you how it's been used, and you would probably say, yeah, you're in agreement, which is very simple. You download software, and in many cases... They say, you want it, just enter this data and just hit this one button and you have it. Now, that to me is one click.
It's not because you have to click more than once.
No, you don't.
Wait, on that one click, you're going to get credit card information, you're going to get warehouse information.
Correct.
No, incorrect.
Yes, because you've entered it in.
No, but you've entered it in with multiple clicks in multiple places.
Let me give you okay. You want an example? I'll give you an example right now.
Go ahead.
Very simple. A couple weeks ago, I renewed my domain registry.
All right.
I just have to go in there and just say, do you want to renew it? And
how did they know who you were renewing?
Oh, because I...
you put in either your name or your account number and clicked it. That's the thing is...
No, I sign on first.
Well, you don't do that with one click, evidently. That's multiple clicks.
Well, then how do you do one click if you don't know what you're doing?
You got me beat. I never read the patent.
Then I challenge you to tell me then, okay?
No, you're challenging me to tell you, and I'll tell you. It's Amazon. That's what I'm asking
for. No, because I'll tell you what. Apple Store, like you go to iTunes, okay? You pick a tune, and then you one click to say, I'm paying for it. But how does Apple know what tune you want unless you go through a prior one saying, I want this tune, now I'm going to pay for it.
And so you're saying that Apple uses the one click?
Correct.
Fine. Does Apple pay a royalty?
Yes.
My point exactly.
Well, then I go to the registry, I say, I want to renew it, and they say, okay, you just told you want to renew it. I click it, and guess what? It's renewed.
I'll have to go back and see.
Do me on that. But tell you what, Joe, let's talk about something that I know you want me to talk about, and that I had an experience. It lasted for a number of months. Okay, and that had to do with I'm running with Windows 10, and I bought a ThinkPad when the Windows 10 was initially released back in 2 years ago, 2015. And, of course, it came with the original distribution of Windows 10. Everything worked fine on it.
Excuse me. The Windows 10 was pre-installed.
Yeah, it was pre-installed on the hardware itself, and it worked fine. And then sometime last year, around the summertime, which coincided with the update, the first big update they had called 1607, and it worked fine. And then I noticed that every once in a while I get the static sound on the speaker. Now, in the old days, when you get a static sound on the speaker, okay, you got a radio next to it, move the radio away. Oh, you got a toaster next to it, move it away. You got a microwave, move it away. Well, I did to the point where I shut down everything, and once in a while, I'll get the static sound. Had nothing to do with any electrical appliances at all.
It was intermittent, not reproducible. You didn't know when it was going to happen.
Correct. So I said, well, it might be caused by... bad software drivers. So I
now that's, excuse me, I would have thought the very first choice would, well, it must have been something causing it, had to be an electrical loose connection or a short or soldering.
Well, I'm telling you the procedure I went through, okay? And the procedure I went through was, okay, because my experience was that in the old days, if you have a laptop next to a radio, you get this buzzing sound. And I said, oh, okay, what do I have that's causing it? Or did I get some leakage from a microwave oven or stuff like that? So that's the first thing you check for. I even turned off the fluorescent light just to make sure it wasn't fluorescent light because the ballast could cause a problem too. So I still had the problem. So what I did was I uninstalled because anytime you want to replace the drivers, you always uninstall first before you reinstall because if you just...
You thought the drivers might have something to do with the static?
Yeah, in other words, first of all, during the running itself, the drivers could become corrupted or an update for the drivers came in. And as you know, one of the things that I really feel upset about is the dropping of memory parity. The update comes in and there's a drop in parity and they go ahead and update it with a bad update. Okay.
But what made you think initially that it was software and not hardware? Because I think most people would initially think that it had something to do with the speakers.
Well, in terms of hardware, there was one thing that I do, but I find that most people, they don't do it because they have to come up with something to do it. But what I did was, instead of running just Windows, okay, I went into the BIOS setup and I booted up a DOS program. And the DOS program was very simple, just playing simple music with a DOS program. And it ran fine, and I kept it running, and absolutely no problem at all.
So that
but for the average user, I don't know if they would do that.
Well, they should, even if they wouldn't. But that proved to you, or at least indicated to you, that it was not hardware.
Well, it could be hardware, but you got to remember, when you run something in DOS, you're really running simple programs, simple sound, and maybe... Like perhaps, you know, like with a complex sound, like, you know, where you have more than one instrument or it's called polyphony. In other words, you hit a certain limit on polyphony. But if you run a DOS program, it's like a simple clarinet sound or, you know, really simple sound. So it still could be hardware, but at least from a a DOS point of view, I had no problems at all. So what I did was I replaced the drivers. Still was not a problem. I said, you know what? Instead of spending all my time trying to find out what the problem is, it's not worth my time, I'll just do a reinstall. So I said to myself...
Well, you were willing to do that because you felt...
Because I had already uninstalled all other programs.
And also, when you first got the machine, you didn't have the static.
Correct. So I figured, you know what? Let me do a factory reset. And I said to myself, okay, it's going to take time because the factory reset will take me to from 1511 to 1607. In other words, the distribution of 2015 to 2016, that which was in the summer. And then you got the more recent one, which is called 1703, which is March, April of this year.
I'd like to interrupt you to point out to our audience, most of whom are old-time listeners with us, Hank is the only human being on Earth who could have said that last sentence, because nobody knows the numbers of these updates.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure many other people know it, Joe. It's you got to remember, Joe, not everyone thinks like you, so therefore they probably do know it. So, Joe, let me tell you what happened, okay? So I did a factory reset, and factory reset gave me 1511, which is the original distribution at the time of purchase, which is like with a new machine. And everything ran fine. Okay, now let me do a Windows update, okay? And I had expected that it was going to, when the update was finished, that I would then have to go through and update again. However, I did something a little different.
Wait, Hank. If I recall, you once explained to me that the update 1511 meant that it was from November 2015.
Correct.
So that gave you a grounding of what you were putting in. Mm-hmm. And you now realize you had to put in 5 years or 6 years worth of updates.
Well, not 5 or 6 years, because at most 2 years. Because as you remember, with Windows 7 or for those who ran with Windows XP, okay, is that... you don't put in SP2 in, okay, until you finish updating with SP1. So that was sort of like the logical progression of thinking, all right? So that was the reason. So when I finished the first update, I went to the start button, and I did a run of WINVER. You know what that is, right?
Yeah, we used to have that on all the earlier versions of Windows. That gives you the actual version that you're currently running.
And it said 1703. In other words, it went directly from version 1511. Not directly, but it actually did all the necessary updates to bring me up to date to 1703.
Just by pressing the one update button.
Yeah, and... Then, of course, there was an announcement made recently by Microsoft that they are implementing something called, what do you think they call it?
Comprehensive updates.
No.
Cumulative updates.
Well, you're close to it. They're calling it Express Updates. And then,
well, what makes it Express Updates?
Well, in fact, when I mentioned that Windows is now using Express Updates, you just figure it means that they're going to be pushing this stuff out, and that's what you probably thought it was.
Express in the sense of fast or something,
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, right. That's what you thought, right?
Yeah.
And I said, no, Joe. And you said, what do you mean? Express updates means either fast or automatically pushed out to you.
But it also, when you explained what it was to me, Hank, it was just as upsetting because you said, no, it's not just Express, but it's cumulative.
Yeah, cumulative. So
I said, wait a minute. Cumulative means that it's everything from day one, which in this case might have been as much as a gigabyte to download.
Well, in this case, they are talking about Express Update from the most recent official release. In other words, like in my case, it was 1511, and the update went to 1607 as one big patch instead of all the little tiny patches that made up 1607. And then from there, it took another step up on the Express update to bring it to 1703.
Now, let me ask you, if the next update consists of, let's say, a megabyte, mm-hmm, of changes.
A gigabyte, I think.
A megabyte,
okay. No, it's a gigabyte. Megabyte's too small.
That's right. I'm saying if they have a megabyte of changes and they're talking about this comprehensive update, they would then merge that megabyte into the rest of the gigabyte that you got.
Correct.
And I would have to download a gigabyte.
Correct.
Even though I'm only looking for a megabyte's worth of changes.
Correct. So what they're doing is that saying that, and I happen to like it because one of the complaints that we have about operating systems is that we get this, what the term is called, the layers of the onion, so that actually, I'll put it in real terms because I know you understand the real terms, okay? You get medicine, and then there's a side effect, and then you get medicine for the side effect, and that has another side effect. So you take another medication, and before you know it, you pile on one medication on top of another.
Right.
Instead of saying, hey, let's go back and say, what do you really need?
But let's, and that's my exact point. I would rather
That's take, a big deal, by the way.
I would rather take what I really need. But Microsoft is saying, no, it's easier for them to patch into the gigabyte
from the official release of whatever that was, 1511 or 1607.
Every time I want to download a little tiny change.
No. Not you want to. It's you say you have no idea what the size is. You say, okay, I'm ready for an update.
Every time I want
You're ready for an update.
Every time I want to download a little tiny change.
No, you call it tiny. I call it you're ready for an update.
Microsoft, in its infinite wisdom, has said, no, you have to download every change there's been since day one.
I said, not day one. Day one. Remember, it's from the last official release you have. In other words, if you have 1607, it's all the cumulative updates from 1607 at that starting point till now.
Okay,
there's a difference
there.
Wait a
minute, I'll show you where you're wrong. If next update comes down, will they send me just the update that comes down, or are they going to go way back to the beginning and send me a gigabyte of updates?
From 1607, if you're running 1607.
And what's the current one?
1703. So if you just got 1703, they'll just give you all the updates starting from the point that 1703 started.
That's not a comprehensive update, then.
No, I didn't say comprehensive. Cumulative update. I didn't say comprehensive. I said cumulative update. The cumulative update is from the last, you know, it's just like in Apple, they had all these.
So in other words, they won't go from what we used to call it, the change that they would send out. Would be an update.
SP1, SP2, SP3, SP4.
If I downloaded SP1.
Service packs, they call them, okay?
I would now download SP2.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'd have SP2, I would only have to download SP3. And if I had SP3, I would only have to download SP4.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how is that different today?
Well, the problem there is that. Let me talk about Windows XP and 7, okay? That's an easy one. If you, say, in XP, you had the Service Pack 2 in, and then you had all these little tiny updates, okay? And they said, oh, you have SP2, now we'll do SP3. SP3 assumes certain patches that you did put in, but in SP2, the way they did it was, you had the option of not having certain patches. Remember that? In other words, you could say, I don't want this patch or I want that patch. So when they come up with this, the next layer of the onion, the SP3, what happens is that you get more coding on top of it to make sure that that you have what you didn't not necessarily update it with. So this way, it's nice and clean. You don't have to worry about did you put it in or not, was it corrupt or not. And in a way, I like it because the reason why I did this big update was I had a problem. Oh, by the way, that the problem with the buzzing sound or the static sound with the speaker, it's all gone. So it's something in the operating system caused it. Now I have the confidence. Now you could say, well, if I worked it through, might I have solved it? Maybe, but do I have 100% confidence that there's absolute integrity in it? No. Okay, so in a way, I happen to like it.
It makes a lot of sense to me on a different level, and that's that if I'm in a situation where there are a lot of machines, an enterprise, a company, a school, I know that everybody is working at the same point.
Yes, and if you got to do it on different points, that's a lot of work to go through individual machines.
I agree with you completely. Yeah.
Hey, Joe, there's one thing I want to cover, I had a club member write to me saying, how can she recycle some equipment? And I remember I get this literature, you know, once every quarter, that there is a collection center at Cunningham Park, and at least in Queens, it's in Cunningham Park.
Here in New York, it was in New York Square.
And you, like, the next one is September such and such, then she came back to me and say, "Gee, she found out that Dell would accept recycled equipment at certain authorized places, you know." And the question I asked was, "Well, do they recycle non-Dell equipment?" The answer was, "I don't know."
No.
So I did a little more work on that and say, "Well, let me find out that instead of waiting for it, what about some of these big electronic shops?" Okay.
Well, back in the day, we used to tell people who had Mac problems or Mac equipment they wanted to recycle.
Yeah, go to TechServe.
TechServe would take anything.
Right.
Anything Mac.
Right.
Well, not anymore, but that was in the day.
So I did a little research and I said, okay, Staples will take will recycle computing equipment of all brands.
Really?
All brands.
Any
including toner cartridges, ink cartridges, Dell equipment, including computing equipment they don't sell.
In any store or just certain stores?
All Staples stores. And by the way, not once a month, not once a quarter, it's every day.
You mean I can just pack up my... Well, I can't. It's too heavy for me. But if I could get somebody to carry my old...
Now, that's interesting you said that because I'm going to answer you, okay? Now, the reason why I say it is because, like, then why should I wait till a certain period of time to take it to Cunningham Park to... You know what? I just go to the nearest Staples store. So I think people should know that.
Absolutely. Now, who else besides Staples?
Best Buy does the same thing. Except they have something a little more than that, okay? They say that on certain types of equipment, which I can understand, all right, like a refrigerator, because all right, they'll even recycle refrigerator, but they ask for a small fee, like I think $14.50. They'll pick up and so on. So in other words, anything that they have to pick up from you, there's a fee, which is understandable. I don't have a problem with that. But if you can bring it in, they'll take it.
It's interesting because if I wanted here in Manhattan to throw away a refrigerator, I have to do several things. I have to notify the city that I want to throw it away, and they will send down a truck to take out the Freon and the...
No. I do it a little differently.
Wait a minute. But before they'll take out the Freon, I have to remove the door from the refrigerator.
Wait, Joe, can I tell you how I just bought a refrigerator 2 years ago. All right? Very simple. I just tell the guy, I'm going to buy a refrigerator, but you have to take out the old one. And he says, well, there's a charge, okay? I said, no problem, okay? And then when a refrigerator is very heavy when you have to take it up more than the first floor. And, you know, the guys that come in, you tip them something that makes them feel happy, okay? So I've done that. Now, I said, gee, okay, you got Best Buy, you have Staples. What about some of the other places? So I checked Micro Center. I was kind of disappointed. Now, I realized that, you know, we tell it like it is, whether it's good news or bad news. Micro Center used to accept recycled equipment. They no longer do it.
That's interesting. Did you find anybody else who did it?
Yes. Does it? You know who else does it? Fry's. Now, Fry's happened to be a regional stores, like, you know, Micro Center's on the central to the east coast. And Fry's is basically West Coast. They will also, like Staples, accept a recycle equipment.
So I think if you check all 50 states, well, maybe 49 of them, maybe 48 of them, I'm rethinking it, will have some form of recycling. Check before. One thing you should not do is you should not just throw it out. Even if you live in a community where you can call the city to get rid of some, I used to live out in a place called Rockville Center, And they could call their encumbrance bureau and make an appointment for the following, either Wednesday or Thursday, I'm not sure which, and their truck would pick up anything, whatever it was. But if I was a good citizen, I wouldn't throw in anything electronic. They would take it. They would have to break it down, and they would send it out to somebody else to be recycled. But a good citizen would do that himself.
Well, one of the things that I have to tell everyone is that before you recycle any computer equipment, you want to make sure that you remove any personal information or important information or critical information on the hard drive or solid-state drive. And
what Hank is referring to is when you have all of your passwords for all of your credit cards and bank accounts on a little file on your computer called passwords.
Now, one of the things that I had intended to do this evening, but I'll probably do it on another day, because it's a much larger picture talking about how do you, you know, get that data off your drive. And I remember, you know, when I was a math major, and one of the things that we learned is that to prove something to be true, you try to prove it's not to be true. And if you could prove that it's not true, therefore it's true, you know. So one of the things that hit me was we talk about how do you, you know, remove the information, how do you zero it out, how do you, you know, short of breaking it, burning it, and so on.
I think the safest way is breaking it and burning it.
Not really.
A next-door neighbor a few years ago told me that somebody in the family had passed, and she wanted to dispose of all of her equipment. And I said to her, the first thing you have to do is make sure all of the data is off it. And she said, oh, it is. She erased everything that's important.
Well, instead of doing that, I thought about it, and maybe people out there who's listening can add to it, is why not encrypt the drive? And if you want to be doubly sure, encrypt it again.
And while that takes some time, you don't need any special equipment to do it.
And you don't have to open up the box, and you just get the piece of software to do it.
One thing I'd like to just, for those of you who are really new users, when you erase a file, you're not erasing that file.
Correct. The data is still there, but if you encrypt it, well,
then the encrypted data is there.
And if you want to make doubly sure, well, encrypt it again. Get to a double encrypt.
It seems to me you would probably need something the equivalent of.
Well, there are encryption programs that are free to do it.
That are very good programs.
Yeah.
And it would probably take a Cray supercomputer to unencrypt it at that point.
Well, you know what? One other thing I want to quickly say is that if you're giving it to a niece, nephew, or someone in the family, that you know, or a good friend, someone you could trust, you know what? Just go to the hidden partition and reinstall the operating system, and you know what? They're not going to go through the trouble of.
Again, be careful. When you just reinstall the operating system from the hidden partition, your data stays there.
You ask
the question, do you want to replace the data?
Yeah, but the thing is, you can recover all those files, but they come out as you don't know the type of file. You get file 001, 002.
I got to just tell you very quickly, I once had a problem with it, and Hank said, don't worry about it. I'll restore all your files. And he sent me back one of those
And you know what? It was a corrupted drive. You couldn't even open it, okay?
I couldn't even open it. He sent me back a little USB with all of my files.
4,000 files.
Carefully numbered from 1 through 4,000, but no names, no file
types. No
types,
but you knew they were PDFs, so that was a hint, okay? hey, listen, Joe, you know, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be covering the fact that PC sales are up. Smartphone sales are up, but tablet sales are down. I'm going to ask the question, do you still use a tablet? And what I've done is that I've asked Marty Winston, I asked him to do something because he lives in Columbia, South Carolina, right in the center of the total solar eclipse. And I says, Marty, what was it like? And he says, you know, the funny thing you asked me about that, I think I'm going to tell you what it was like. So he's going to do that, and he's going to I had a discussion with him about vacuum tube computing. Now, of course, you know, that's for old-timers like, you know, old gizzards like Joe and Mike. Did you ever work on vacuum tube, Joe?
Yes, as a matter of fact,
I worked on vacuum tube computing, and we're going to touch on what it was like on using vacuum tubes or even neon tubes. You know what neon tubes are, right?
No, I never did that.
Well, I guess you'll have to listen to it, so let's get to it. Do you still use a tablet? I am a big advocate of specific tools for specific tasks. But if you are traveling, you will most likely want to minimize what you want to have in your carry-on bag. Whether it is a business trip or pleasure trip, I take along a digital camera. Many of you may be satisfied with pictures taken with a smartphone or tablet. On a business trip, I take along a compact camera. The purpose of the trip is work itself and not sightseeing. On a pleasure trip, I will take with me the interchangeable lens mirrorless camera with a compact camera for backup. Packed with the photographic equipment is a smartphone. I leave the tablet at home. A larger question has been whether I am still using the tablet. The answer is, when I'm at home, the tablet is chosen for the larger screen and greater ease for data entry. Since its introduction, tablets run with all kinds of operating systems. Tablets come in different sizes and sold at various price points. But the big question is, do you really need a tablet anymore? Research firm IDC's recent study shows that tablet sales are on the decline worldwide. So before you put down hard-earned cash for a new tablet, ask yourself a simple question. Do you really need it? Here's some food for thought. Functionally, what is the difference between a small tablet and an oversized screen cell phone? The difference are not functional. The difference are in usability. They differ on portability, advantage, the smartphone. They differ on view screen size, advantage, the tablet. They differ on data entry, advantage, the tablet. They differ on flexibility of telephone usage. The advantage is to the smartphone. The tablet is squeezed by laptops are getting lighter. The big change in the world of laptops recently is their shrinking in size and weight. Manufacturers are trending towards notebooks with 11-inch screens that focus on being lightweight. That used to be the big advantage of tablets. For a few years, it made more sense to carry a tablet with you when you're moving around because a laptop was too big, bulky, and it would weigh down your bag. But modern lightweight, small-sized laptops make it easier to carry and no matter where you go. Let's face it, when you're on the go, you will always carry your smartphone with you. So the second device is the one you have to decide. Do you want a tablet, which has the same apps and restrictions as your smartphone? Or do you want a laptop which has a keyboard and a full-fledged desktop operating system? The choice is pretty clear. One other recent trend is most indicative of whether you need a tablet or not. As IDC has found in 4 quarters in a row, tablet sales are shrinking. Sales are growing for 2-in-1 tablets that mimics a PC. From the Microsoft Surface to the iPad Pro, people are buying tablets that come with a detachable keyboard because they can be replacements for PCs or laptops. Tablets have one big problem right now, which is writing and input. As good as virtual keyboards and touch gestures are, they still don't match up to a physical keyboard and mouse or trackpad for pinpoint accuracy and speed. More importantly, 2-in-1s give you the best of both worlds, a tablet that can be used as a tablet and a laptop that can be used as a laptop, both shifting into their own roles as required. However, there is a place for tablets. If the primary use of your tablet is going to be used to read e-books, consider an alternative. E-readers are better for your eyes due to the e-ink, and they can store all the e-books that you could ever need at a time, and are much lighter and therefore more comfortable to use. In fact, the lightness of an e-reader matters a lot. You're going to hold this device in your hand for a long time as you flip through the pages, and even the 7-inch tablets are heavy enough that your arm will just feel strained after a few minutes. That's not the case with most e-readers. More and more people are using tablets, less and less. We'd like to hear from you if you're still using the tablet, or has it become an ornamental gizmo or a doorstop lying around somewhere? And if you still use it, what do you use it for? Hey Marty, before we start off with your segment, I understand that you were in the center of the total solar eclipse. We're in the Northeast area. Well, we really didn't see much of the effect at all of the solar eclipse. What was it like?
Is everybody still squinting from watching Monday's eclipse? Our build house, our 40-year house, the build site is on a street that quite literally crossed Monday's eclipse totality zone. 100 yards further down the street was not total eclipse. Our lot was, and several of the neighbors were over there. We're on a little hillock on the street. Want to tell you about it. I mean, certainly it starts with the moon next to the sun, and the moon encroaches, and you see a little dent on the side of the sun, and then it looks like the Apple logo, and then it's like watching the sun being a backlit fast phases of the moon thing until you get just a fingernail sun, and as the moon overlays the sun perfectly, you can see, in fact, you can take the dark glasses off at that point and see a corona ring in the sky. But you want to have your glasses back on, or you did, when that corona turned into a diamond ring shape with that little bit of glare as an edge of the sun came through, and that almost always happens. The alignment is never quite perfect, although it's very close. Other effects, other than in the sky, we were out in the country. It didn't bother the horses at all, but the birds and insects seemed to quiet down as if it were nighttime. The nighttime insects came out. There were some breezes that came just ahead and more just after the eclipse that cooled down because, of course, the breezes were just ahead of the nighttime zone. So as those temperatures changes, air moved, and as the eclipse moved, the air came with, and we got a cooling breeze right ahead of it. Other effect, oh, by the way, I mentioned that the street is about 100 yards from the edge of the totality zone. We could look down the street, and when we were dark from the total eclipse, the other end of the street had light. That was kind of dramatic. Also, the coolest thing about it, you look full circle, there's a 360-degree sunset every point on the horizon. That's how we did it in South Carolina. For those of you who were in New York for the eclipse, we're south of that.
Thank you, Marty. Well, let's get back to the subject at hand. You and I were talking about back in the old days, going back to when we had vacuum tubes for computers. You were talking about, yeah, we had other kinds of tubes too. So, Marty, tell us more.
Even in the context of our cybernetic 40-year house, everything old is new again. I'm going to take you back about 50 years. Hope you can remember that far back. If you don't, you'll catch up. Don't worry about it. There was a small neon lamp, the NE2 lamp, that you could buy for 9 cents. If you had half a buck, you might go for the big bayonet mount NE51. In each case, these things were, oh, I don't know, about the size of a cold capsule. Slightly different shape. The NE2 had bare pigtails on it. The other one was for mounting in a socket. In each was a glass envelope, a bulb, if you would, with neon gas, sometimes neon in a mix with something else like argon, and two parallel posts. And the way these things worked was if you got their voltage high enough, 60 to 70 volts was generally it, then the gas would ionize. It would break down, it would glow, and it would pass current between the electrodes. In so doing, well, the electrodes kind of, gave up their ghost after a while. They would wear out. That would anodize them or ionize them. And in any case, they were only good for a limited lifespan. But the fact that you had this cheap little orange bulb meant a lot. And let's talk about why they were cheap. And this is why it's going to bring back your memory. If you ever passed a little orange nightlight, it's probably one of these neon bulbs in it. If you remember the backlighting on table radios and on consoles and on some channel selectors on TV sets back then, the backlight was orange because it was one of these cheap little lamps in it, and they didn't need replacing as often as incandescent lamps. If you can remember the moving pointers on stereo tuners that had that orange glow, it was one of these things with a little mask over it. Neon lamps were all over the place back then. In fact, you could buy TV lightning arresters. They probably weren't very good at doing much more than dissipating static. That was essentially one of these things between the antenna connection and ground. It was just, it hits 70 volts, it conducts bang. It's not good for that much current. I loved putting these things together. You'd use a diode, a resistor, a capacitor, and one of these things. The resistor limited the charge of the diode and also the current through the lamp. So the capacitor would build the charge, because it was DC coming through the dial, would build the charge, and when it hit the trigger point of the lamp would fire and blink. And you could put 15 or 16 of these in a piece of pegboard and have a poor man's version of the sea view display of blinking lights all over the place, all orange, not colorful. Oh, darn. Those were Christmas lights, weren't they? Well, we don't know. It doesn't matter. But those orange lights, those little neon bulbs, are relevant again. They were a form of gas discharge tube. Gas, neon, some of them argon, some of them mixes. Gas discharge tube that triggers at a given voltage, usually fairly high, usually, you know, for those old lamps, 60, 70 volts, and then conducts. And where do you think that has application these days? Yes, surge protectors. And in fact, Underwriters Laboratory just rewrote the standards for surge protectors and how they would be configured in various kinds of equipment. And you will find the requirement for gas discharge tubes to shunt large charges to ground is now a requirement for things in manufacture at this point in various categories, like backup power systems. So if the surge protector in a backup power system, instead of just having the shunts that an MOV, metal oxide varistor, provides, also provides gas discharge tube shunts to ground when it flashes, when it fires, you have that extra level of protection. And it, in fact, it does help a bit get those MOVs survive a little longer. Is it self-destructive? Depends on the size of the charge. It depends on the nature of the tube, size of its electrodes, other things. But ultimately, yeah, it's going to go away. Ultimately, yeah, that protection will be gone. They'll figure it out. They'll let us know one way or another, blink something or scream something when you've got to replace that part of it. I'm mentioning gas discharge tubes, those lovely little orange lights. I still have images of the blinking wall above my workbench in those days. I mentioned those and that level of surge protection because it should be in your mental picture of how surge protection happens. Gas discharge tubes are one of the oldest components in that mix. I mentioned in the context of Ethernet surge protection, Schottky diodes, which will self-destruct if too much voltage hits them. We've heard of metal oxide varistors that have non-linear responses to being hit by voltages, and their resistance profile can change dramatically if they're hit by a big enough pulse. There's also avalanche devices. Avalanche devices will, again, cause whoom, a big flood of current flow when they're hit with the right voltages. So there's this whole little collection of components that all do essentially the same thing. If too big a voltage appears, they find a way to shunt it to ground or to short something out so a breaker will go or to otherwise stop it before it gets to the equipment on the other side of the connection. In power, it's the stuff you've got plugged in. What would you rather blow, your computer or a surge protector? What would you rather blow? A power supply or an entire thing? What would you rather blow? That's what surge protection's about. It's also important to notice that surge protection does not give you any kind of a backup. And what's important? Surge protectors die. All surge protectors eventually die. Rule of thumb, and it's impossible to read it. You can't even really come up with a circuit that can reliably tell you if a surge protector is still good. You have to open it up and use a microscope on the component. But you can bet that if you've had something for more than, oh, 5, 6, 7 years, it's time to replace it. Just don't trust it. Get rid of it. You've had 7 years out of it. Let's not be stingy. And getting a new strip, especially if that strip is being manufactured now, and you know, be good for the holidays, right? Getting a new strip will give you the protection you want for the much more expensive stuff that's behind it. I think I've made the point. surge protection, whether it's based on a 50-year-old flashing orange light or it's based on the cool semiconductors that happened today, or it's based on, oh, I haven't mentioned this. This was used as an antenna lightning arrestor, a spark plug. I don't recommend that. But anything that's going to make that surge go to ground is something that can protect the stuff that you want protected. And protection is almost as important as backing up. Because if you're protected, you may not need to exercise the mandate to back up, back up, back up. But I would anyway, wouldn't you, Hank?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements of regional computer clubs in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, August 24th at 6:45 p.m., and the presentation is Tips for Staying Safe Online, Preventing Ransomware and Identity Theft. They'll be meeting at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on astrophotography Tuesday, September the 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on passwords, how LastPass can help, Tuesday, September the 5th at 1:30 p.m., Community Room at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on the power of networking, Thursday, September the 7th at 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, located on 120 Bloomingdale Road, room 101, White Plains, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting scheduled for September 8th at 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, located on the Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Rockland PC Users Group will have a meeting on Tuesday, September the 12th. Meeting time is 7:15 p.m., Rassel Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Mall in West Nyack. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have a presentation on Rules of Thumb for Computer Security, Thursday, September the 14th at 7 p.m., meeting place is at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building. Check at the front desk for room number, 31 Washington Place, Manhattan, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on AT&T Digital Life Home Automation, Friday, September the 15th at 8 p.m. They'll be meeting at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartow Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting scheduled for Tuesday, September the 26th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Meeting will be held at the Mercer County Library, located at Lawrenceville, New Jersey. All these meetings are open to the public and there is no charge for attendance. We all hope to see you there at the meetings. The website for the Personal Computer Radio Show is www.pcradioshow.org. And we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and keep cool until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.